Direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
James Show. And a couple weeks ago on the weekend, we replayed an interview we did several years ago with Peter Crist, and I was struck again by his wisdom. You know, I thought I knew every argument about the war on drugs, but in one sentence, Peter nailed it in such a way that it has reverberated in my mind ever since. And when I look at the denizens of Washington, everybody who's been in the White House and over the last 20 years, I think about what he said. He may not even remember it, but I'm sure he says it often, though, but you'll meet him in a minute if you haven't already. And that is, tell me, are any of the individuals who have done drugs in the past, would any of them be better off today if they were also a felon? Well, actually, maybe the country would, now that I think about who's in Washington. But that said, welcome to Peter Crist. Thanks for joining us.
Raleigh, thanks for having me back on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your audience again.
You know, the logic that in that one statement alone is just, I can't see how there's anyone that you have ever talked to who could refute that. As soon as somebody says, well, that can't be right, they've got to be coming at it from strictly an emotional perspective.
Well, the reality of this thing is a good friend of mine is an addiction psychiatrist up here in Syracuse, New York, and he said to me many years ago, he said, the problem with this country is when the Puritans got kicked out of England and got on the boat, they went west instead of east. If they had gone east, they would have landed on the shores of Belgium or France, and they would have been told, make peace with your morality or stay on the boat. Instead, they came over here, nobody was warned, and the first thing that they built were pillories and donkey stools, punishment to get morality from people. Law enforcement, I was a cop for 20 years. My job is not morality policing. My job is peace officer when there is a problem between citizens to restore peace, and if there is someone that needs to be held responsible for their activities to make sure that they get to the court. That was what I was trained and what I'm able to do, and ironically, that is what the public helps me do when I'm doing it. When I'm running around telling people what drugs they should take or who they should be sleeping with or what they should be betting on, people don't want to talk to me. They don't want to work with me. They just want to be left alone and go get the bad guys, okay? So we've slowly been moving police out of this area. I mean, I saw a thing on the gay issue back about 2 years ago on PBS, and at the beginning it said that in 1960 it used to be illegal to be gay in every state but Illinois. Okay, well, we stopped doing that. We stopped arresting we stopped arresting women for voting. We stopped arresting people for marrying people who had darker skin color than they did. We've gone through all these processes. This drug war is one of the most grievous examples of this type of policy, and also one of the best examples of how it never works.
You are so right. And yes, I should mention you are a retired police captain after 20 years, and it was you who came up with the idea of creating LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And right there, when you think of the title of your organization, everyone who is a member has been on the front lines of this and has seen firsthand how deleterious our war on drugs is. And where we are now is such an interesting place, because on the one hand, we hear about Eric Holder say, go easy on low-level drug offenders for prison overcrowding. And you then hear him saying, well, we'll respect state sovereignty. And on the one hand, that seems very hopeful. On the other hand, that screams of selective enforcement.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, when Holder came out with that remark, I had people ask me, well, what'd you think of that? And I said, well, I'd compare it to this. If in 1863, instead of signing the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln had signed a law that said that you could not hold any slaves over the age of 50. Now, that would have been good for all the slaves over the age of 50, but it would have let slavery stay intact. What Holder is saying is trying to minimize this. You know, I said many years ago that prohibition is a luxury item.
Yes.
When you have a lot of money flowing in, you can spend your time worrying about how your neighbors are cutting their lawn or what color their paint are. But if money gets tight, you don't really give a damn what your neighbors are doing unless they're doing it to you and you don't want it. Otherwise, let them do whatever they want to do. I just got myself to take care of here. Mm-hmm. We cannot afford this. We have almost tripled our prison population in this country over the last 10 years. A third of themselves, one-third of those prison cells, are filled by non-violent drug offenders. These are not people that are in there on a plea-down charge to drug possession when they were charged with murder or something like that, like the government likes to make you think. Mm-hmm. These are people that were charged with possession, convicted of possession, or of selling a drug to somebody who wanted to buy it. And anytime I mention prisons, I always want to make sure that everybody understands this. We have the largest prison population on the planet Earth. We have one of the most efficient prison systems on the planet Earth. You hardly ever hear of anybody escaping from one of our prisons. And you want to take a guess, Raleigh, on how many drug-free prisons we have in America?
Zero.
Zero, exactly. Even the super max prisons have a drug problem within them. And the reason I mention that is I want every listener that just heard that to remember that the next time tomorrow morning when they're going to work and they drive by the high school and they see that drug-free school sign out there. Okay, just remember that the difference between the people in that school and the people in the prison is the people in that school have all their liberties, and the people in the prison have none of theirs, and we can't keep drugs out of prisons.
Yeah, and if you can't keep them out of prison, you know you're not gonna keep them out of anything. Interestingly, we're seeing more and more privatization of prisons. We're seeing more and more push from people with special interests to say, you know, lock them up and send them away. But when I look at this issue, and like you, I think you can speak, you're an expert at this because 20 years on the front lines of this, you know. I feel I'm pretty good speaking on this because I've never taken an illegal drug in my life. I have no interest in it. I don't care. So I have no horse in this race. I'm a senior citizen who doesn't like to take the legal drugs, for God's sakes. So I'm not pushing for what I want. But over the years, and it happened even when we talked last time, after you and I conclude the conversation, boy, the onslaught of calls, and mostly the most religious, of course, are the former offenders. And what I found was there is almost a hysteria about this, the idea that if we legalize them, something terrible will happen, and nothing in the history of mankind would point that out.
Well, I think we have to be honest about it, don't we, Raleigh? I mean, look what happened in 1933. We legalized alcohol in this country, and this country fell into a drunken stupor. We lost World War II. We're now all speaking German. You know, I mean, give me a break. That was exactly what the prohibitionists threatened. If you legalize alcohol, everybody will become a drunk. We have legal alcohol in this country, and less than 50% of the adult population consume alcohol. And we, since we started enforcing, doing our job, and by that I mean law enforcement's job, and enforcing DWI laws and stuff like that, since we started that, thanks to Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the late 70s, we have greatly reduced the amount of harm that is done by alcohol. I just want to make it clear to people that there's two separate, completely separate issues here. One is the drug problem. And as Gawkowski, the drug czar, says, as Eric Holder says, as the President of the United States says, and I don't mean just this president, but every president, this drug problem is fundamentally a health care and an educational problem. Okay. Now, every time they say that, no reporter ever asks the question that is screaming in my head when I hear that, and that is, what other education and healthcare problem should we spend the vast amount of our spending on the criminal justice system to deal with it? If it's a healthcare and an education problem, we should be spending our money on healthcare and education, not the criminal justice problem. But that's the drug problem. Here's the problem that we at LEAP, law enforcement against prohibition, are fighting against, and that is the prohibition problem. And that prohibition of those drugs is what has created this huge underground marketplace. The murders, we talk about murders on the streets of Syria. Look at Chicago and look at the homicide rate in Chicago today. It's unbelievable. And Mexico, they've lost 60,000 people over the last 10 years down there to not drug-related shootings, but prohibition-related shootings, people fighting over the marketplace. Legalization of drugs is not to be considered as an answer to the drug problem. Legalization of drugs is an answer to the crime and violence problems. Once we defund these gangs, they no longer draw the people in that want to come and help work them because they got all this money. We take their money away from them, they fold up. The homicide rate in America, and you can, anybody that's listening can check this, go to Bureau of Justice Statistics, type in homicide rate USA 1900 to today, and you'll see a graph. And from 1900 until about 1920, it just kind of bounces along up and down a little bit each year. By 1920, it starts climbing. Mm-hmm. And every year from 1920 until around 1933, the homicide rate went up every year. It peaked around 1932-33. In 1933, we legalized alcohol. By the way, the drug that has the closest relationship with violence is alcohol. Mm-hmm. We legalized alcohol, and by 1937, just 4 years after we legalized alcohol, the homicide rate in America was back down to what it was in 1919 before Prohibition started. And I also want to point out that 1937 was not a happy time in America. We had some areas 30-40% unemployment rates. It was the deepest period of the Depression. But yet people weren't killing each other because we took that product away from them and gave it to licensed distributors. Budweiser and Miller, if they have a dispute, they don't take it to the streets. They take it to the courts.
Well said. The other thing about this, of course, is that those who see it as fighting the drug problem rather than the drug prohibition, you look at kids today. It is harder for them to come across alcohol than drugs, and very much so. And in fact, for some of them, that's why drugs became the high of choice, if you will. Regulation always leads to a better, safer society, not only to mention, of course, the tax revenues, but what you have. And years ago when I was in music radio, one of my programmers said, oh, well, the worst zealots about this are the girls who were high through all of college, get married, have two kids, and Timmy and Danny, well, we have to keep them away from drugs. Drugs must be illegal. And, you know, I thought about it at that time. I said, you know, that's pretty much it. It's that fear and that desire that somehow by making something off limits, then it won't affect them. And nowhere in the history of mankind has making something illegal done anything to diminish want. If anything, it of course, it raises the price, but in some sectors, it increases want.
Right. In fact, do you know what the very case, the very first incidence of prohibition that we have any record of?
What?
It started with these words.
Oh, Adam in the Bible.
Oh, yeah. Do not eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Yeah.
Okay? All right? And by the way, first example of zero tolerance.
Yes, I say.
All right.
And look at where we are now. Wait a minute. You might be fighting for the other side, Peter.
Yeah, I know. But my point is, it tells you in that book of Genesis why it didn't work. And it says in there that after the Creator created the two people, the Creator granted something to the creation, and that was called free will, the right to choose whether or not. And that Creator-given gift, is what we are attempting to prohibit in our society. And if you don't understand anything else, I'm going to make one simple statement: prohibiting things that people want to do with each other does not stop them from doing it, but only drives it underground and turns something that there was no complaint about except the people that weren't doing it. They didn't like it. So it creates crime, and if there's a money connection to this activity, it creates violence in your society. I was up in Vermont first week of June, and I'm up there doing some presentations in some Rotary clubs, and one of the things I mentioned to them was this. I said to them, I'll tell you an insane adult activity that human beings, just like you and me, Raleigh, do this stuff. And people get maimed and die every year doing this. Every year. There are people, just like you and me, who when they see a tall, icy mountain, the first thought that comes into their head is, I ought to climb up on top of that mountain and tie two slippery boards to my feet and push myself off the edge. No, that's it. Killed Sonny Bono. Sonny Bono died doing that, okay? And I looked at those people in Vermont and I said, we should ban it. And I paused for a second. I said, what would happen if we banned it? Well, the first thing that would happen is Vermont would go broke, okay? But the next thing that would happen is this. I'll bet you this. The amount of people hurt and killed doing it would go up. Because now they wouldn't be doing it on groomed slopes regulated where there's safety crews nearby and people to get them help and teach them how to do it safely. Now they'd just be doing it out in the woods someplace and more people would die and more people would be injured. So we accept the activity, we regulate and control it to make it as safe as possible, and then we move on. And that's what you do in a free society. I would not even be suggesting this if I lived in Syria, because there, their book is the law of the land. So it's different there. But we in America are all forced to wear two hats. One is our American hat, and the other one is our morality hat. Whether we tie that to religion or whatever other thing, and those are two separate things, and everybody is allowed to wear whatever morality hat they want to as long as they do not harm other people or other people's property.
You know, it's interesting with your Vermont analogy, there's another factor too, and that's the guy who has a bunch of private land who happens to have a tall mountain. He's going to be the richest guy in the state.
Oh, and, exactly.
So now we get into the individuals who have a very vested interest in keeping drugs illegal. In fact, they'll kill anybody who wants to legalize this. And, you know, that's where I become the conspiratorialist. But I'm sure you've looked at every side of this. I mean, we have a UN, for God's sakes, that went crazy when Holder said that he'd respect state sovereignty. So clearly there are people here who, apart from morality, have a vested financial interest. And in your research, what's really behind this? Who's really behind this?
Well, the first group that have a vested interest that do not like a thing that I'm saying are the drug cartels.
Right, of course.
So let's just get them. Let's get them right off the plate, right off the bat. Then, as you mentioned just earlier, we have created a private prison industry in this country. We now have prisons that are profit-making institutions, and it's very interesting because out in California, when they were having some discussion about the marijuana thing, one of the biggest groups out there that was against it was the Prison Officers Association. Okay, and they didn't want this to go away. Now you got to understand, if we lose a third of the prison population, that means we're going to lose probably about a third of the prison guards. So they're looking for their own jobs to be held. Now I mentioned a couple years ago, I said, how about this? How about we reduce the prison population by a third, but we keep the same number of prison guards, and instead of having them be guards, they should start being corrections officers and actually start doing some corrections instead of just incarcerating people. There's one thing that we have to remember. More than 90% of our prison population in America today have one thing in common, and that is this. They are coming home. Only about 10% of them are in there for life. Now, we sent these people away because we were having a problem with them, and they're coming back. Do we want them coming back better or worse than we sent them away? currently we're sending them back worse, because the first thing we're sending them back with is a record, and that cuts down on their opportunities for jobs. And if it was a drug conviction and they want to come back and straighten their life up and go to college but they can't afford it, well, I'm sorry, you got a drug conviction, so the government won't give you a student loan. Okay? That's how we say we're trying to do better by this. You know, it's interesting. I had a friend of mine say to me many, many years ago that this drug war could be over with tomorrow. And I said, how would you do that? And he said, well, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., you have every illegal drug user in America report to their local police department and turn themselves in. And well, we got 20 million people out there asking for a prison cell. We currently have a little over 2 million prison population. We can't afford that. What are we going to do with all of them? Now, I'll tell you something. If every rapist turns himself in tomorrow, we got a prison cell for every one of them.
Sure. Sure.
But we don't have a prison cell for all the drug users, I'll tell you. So that's another reason why this is the bad policy, because it is not effective. It does not create what we want to create. You know, it's kids growing up and their parents set a curfew for them for 10 p.m. You got to be in by 10 p.m., but the parents never get home before 11 p.m. You know what time the kids get in, 10:55.
Right.
Okay? That's how human beings are. That's not evil. That's just being human. We like to do the things that we like to do, and we want to continue to do them, particularly when the people doing them don't believe it's doing them any harm. And trust me, we have created a lot of myth about this stuff. I can remember Senator D'Amato up here in New York State used to give speeches back in the 70s, and he'd say, how could you legalize a drug like cocaine that creates addiction from the first use? Well, that's absurd. That shows a complete ignorance of the process of addiction. It's totally wrong. Only about 10 to 15% of the people that use any of these drugs are addicted to them. The vast majority of the people that use these drugs are casual users. I was at a presentation one time, and a guy came up to me at the end, and we were talking, and somebody had mentioned earlier that he owned a tavern, and he didn't really agree with my position. And I asked him, I said, would you do me a favor starting tomorrow and for the next 30 days at your tavern? He said, what's that? Because he had just got done telling me how all these heroin addicts and all these crack addicts and all. I said, I want you to put a sign in the window of your tavern. I want you and all of your customers to totally obey the sign. He said, what's the sign going to say? I said, only alcoholics served. And he looked at me and he said, I'd be nuts to do that. I said, why? He said, I'd go broke. There aren't enough of them to keep me in business. I said, you know what? That's what makes you just like a heroin seller. Exactly the same problem.
Right.
If you're only selling to addicts, you're going to go broke. You need all these casual users to keep you in business. But we create this myth about these drugs. Addiction is not something that is caused by the drug. Addiction is something within the individual that the individual takes to the drug. And that can be anything. In fact, for Bill Bennett, our former drug czar, he was addicted to gambling.
Right.
All right? At his own admission. Now, he wasn't running around calling for all the slot machines to be destroyed, you know, or all the Indian casinos to be shut down, or shut down all the lotteries and let's get the numbers racket back going again in this country.
Exactly.
Those were the days.
Right. And I want to get into, again, what's motivating people to do this, because what you're saying is not only logical on the surface, but as you research this further, it's absolute incontrovertible fact. It's not opinion.
Right.
And as far as the illegality, if there is harm in drugs, and for some people there will be, just like there will when they take the prescription from their doctor. But taking a street drug is really like, you know, playing the lottery, because you don't have control over what it's cut with. You know, years ago when Lenny Bruce died, I remember being with a group of people, we all had known him, and a friend of mine said, well, the easiest person to kill, baby, is a junkie. And that was absolutely true. You get the wrong mixture, you don't know. So for people who are saying, well, it's a public health issue and we have to keep him illegal, that's creating the issue. I've got Peter Crist with me. He started LEAP many years ago now, and in 2002, it finally emerged as a nonprofit educational organization, and it's done a wonderful job since then. If you've got any calls, you betcha I'll take them. LEAP.cc is the website. I've got a link at Raleigh.net directly to it, and I defy you to punch a hole in Peter's logic. If you want to try it, I'm here to take your call.
It's the Raleigh James Show.
And while we're waiting, I'm going to mention the Sea Crane Company a moment. If you're listening online, get yourself a Wi-Fi radio. I talk about that all the time. It's the convenience of it. It takes every stream online, puts it onto a radio, just like AM or FM, but instead of a dozen stations near you, over 20,000 stations around the world, listed by genre, by location. If you, like me, are always screaming, "There's nothing I want to hear," well, this will solve that. Many Wi-Fi radios from which to choose. The CC Wi-Fi is my favorite. And the reason for that is probably Bob Crane, a radio lover who had a hand in developing this. And it's great. It's got buttons and knobs and an alarm and a clock. And, you know, it's also got a remote control with 99 presets. And I'll tell you, when you've got over 20,000 from which to choose, you'll find your favorite 99 in a hurry. Comes with a built-in speaker. But in my case, I have a little pillow speaker that I got from the Sea Crane Company. Put it right under my pillow. Never disturb John when he doesn't want to hear it. And, of course, I'm up all night listening to something. It's just terrific. Small and compact. It looks good. It works good. It's a terrific radio. It's $99.95, and if you mention the coupon code James, you get 5% off your entire order, no matter what you order. You can either do that online at ccrane.com, and there's a link at Raleigh.net, or you can give them a call tomorrow. They will be back in the office, and unlike any other internet retailer I know, the Sea Crane Company has the kind of customer service that predates even the thought of the internet. It's real people-to-people business. So they're not there now. Operators are not standing by. They'll be there tomorrow, in person, in the flesh. You'll talk to them in the office in Fortuna, California, at 888-444-7993. That's 888-444-7993. If you want a free catalog, if you like to hold them in your hands, they'll mail you one. If you want to go online, you can see the whole catalog online at ccrane.com. It's ccrane.com. The Wi-Fi radio, 888-444-7993, or ccrane.com, as I say. Now, while you're looking around, you know, there's so many other neat things, many utilitarian, the kind of things you never think about until you need one, like the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3. If your Wi-Fi signal is just awful, I'll tell you, and you think, all I can do is move, or if you're on the road and you're always looking for those hot spots and you never really are in one for too long, man, the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3 is just a dream. It works great at home in your RV, your boat, your car. Easily plugs into the USB port of your computer or your laptop. You will get a dramatic boost in signal strength, speed, and reliability. You'll be receiving signals from 400 feet away. Yeah. So if you're wanting to log on to that free Wi-Fi that some business you're not in has, well, I'm not suggesting that. It'll work. Water resistance, designed for outdoor use, comes with a 15-foot cable. Easy to install software. The Super USB 3, and you can read all about that at the Sea Crane Company as well. And one more, the CC Spotlight. Everybody needs a great flashlight. And this is another thing. Who the heck thinks about that until they're in the dark by the side of the road and they're in trouble, right? Well, the CC Spotlight is just that. It's great for power outages or outdoor use. I keep it with the car for the obvious reason. It uses one super efficient LED light bulb, and you get three lighting modes. You're going to have it on low, medium, or flash. And I'll tell you what, you use this on its greatest power, and not only will you be able to use that for 25 hours or 175 hours on the low beam, but it's got a little stand. You will be able to set it and see everything you're looking for. And the stand for me is important because if you've lifted the hood, for instance, in the middle of nowhere and you're trying to put the flashlight somewhere so you actually will see what might be wrong, man, that stand comes in very handy. So again, things you don't think about till you're in trouble. Good time to think about some emergency preparedness now. $49.95. The Sea Crane Company at 888-444-7993. And don't forget, if you mention James, you get 5% off that as well. It's the Sea Crane Company, and they really are terrific.
Do re mi fa sol la ti. My uncle there was a pastor. surprising me. She got a whole lot of rhythm when she walks, and I can hear music when she talks. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. Forget about the do and think about me. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. I wonder who can this creature be? She ain't Mona Lisa as I can see, but I don't care, she looks good to me. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. Forget about the do and think about me.
Paranoid to the max, The Raleigh James Show. Call Raleigh now at 888-876-5593,
888-RALEIGH. I always laugh at that. Forget about the dough and think about me. But when you're talking about the war on drugs, you really can't forget about the dough, because there are some real winners here. And they aren't you. We're talking to Peter Crist, retired as a police captain after a 20-year career enforcing drug laws. This is someone who knows his stuff. Came up in 2002, put together as an international nonprofit, LEAP. You can check it out at leap.cc, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And done a lot of good educating the public. And that's really what this is more than anything, is an education campaign. And Peter, I contend that if the American public was remotely as wise as you are on this, that the government couldn't pull off its war on drugs. It takes uninformed, frightened citizens. In the over 10 years you've been talking to people, what progress have we made?
Well, we're making some progress. I know people think that, oh, all this marijuana stuff, well, marijuana has never been leached. Issue. I mean, it's part of it, but it's not the whole thing. In fact, my fear is that we'll legalize marijuana and then we'll lose a lot of people in the movement because they will have their marijuana. And then we'll go through about a 2-year lull, and then all of a sudden you're going to hear people saying, wait a minute, we still got the gang warfare, we still got all the shootings, and then we're going to have to start the discussion all over again. Kind of like when people thought that the right to vote for women was the end of the women's argument.
Right.
And women got the right to vote in 1920, and the women's rights movement lay dormant in this country until almost the 1960s, mm-hmm. before it really started generating any activity. So these things take a long time. You were talking about money and how people make money. I mentioned the private prison systems, which, let me tell you, in a free society, nobody should make a profit off of denying somebody their liberty. That should not be a profit-making business.
Agreed.
Okay? And there's another thing that we have, and we call it forfeiture. Now, I just want to make clear,
yes,
there are two types of forfeiture. One type of forfeiture I have absolutely no problem with, and I think is a very good idea, and that is called criminal forfeiture.
Correct.
And what that means is that, let's say I'm a bank robber for the last 10 years, and finally they arrest me, and after they arrest me and they're searching my house, they find all this gold bullion and stuff like that. Well, they're going to seize that property because they're going to say, I got this for my bank robberies, but they'll hold on to it until I am convicted of the bank robberies.
Mm-hmm.
And once I'm convicted of the bank robberies, they will then keep the gold. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's criminal forfeiture. I think that's perfectly legit. Civil forfeiture is this. And I'd like to use this as an example just to give you a little picture to look at so people know what I'm talking about. Just for this conversation, Raleigh, you and I grew up together, and we both had this friend, and he happened to be a man and lived in the our friend of ours lived in the inner city. He's a black man, and we played ball together in school and stuff like that. And now it's like 15 years later, and I run into you and we're talking, and I mention our buddy. And I say, what's he doing now? And you say, well, remember his father used to have an appliance store in the city? And I say, yeah. And you say, well, he's running the appliance store now. And I said, really? I just bought a 10-unit apartment building, and I need 10 refrigerators, 10 stoves, 10 dishwashers. I'll go down and stop and see him. So I drive into the city, and on the way down, I stop at the bank, and I take $10,000 in cash out of my bank account because it's my money, and I should have a right to do that. So I put it in my pocket, and I drive down to where the store used to be. and it's a vacant building because you forgot to tell me he moved.
Mm-hmm.
There's some young people standing out in front of the store, so I roll down my passenger side window and I yell out to him, "Hey, excuse me," and one of them walks over to the car, and I say, "Hey, there used to be an appliance store here. Do you know anything about it?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, he's one block down, two blocks over." I say, "Okay." I pull away. There's red lights on in the rearview mirror of my car.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an honest guy. I pull over. I'm told, asked for my license and registration. I'm told to step out of the car. They told me to put my hands up against the car. They pat me down. As they pat me down, they feel this bulge in my pocket, and they pull the money out, and they say, "What's this?" And I go, "What do you mean? You just took it from my pocket. It's my money." And they said, "Yeah, send a tow truck." "A tow truck? What do you do? We're taking your car. Here's a receipt for the money." "A receipt for the money? What are you arresting me for?" And here is where it comes in. We're not arresting you for anything.
Mm-hmm.
We just know that you're down here to buy drugs. That's why you were talking to those drug dealers back there on the corner. We're not stupid. So we're going to seize your car and your money. And I go, "Well, how do I get it back? I didn't know what I was down. I'm down here to buy appliances." And they say, "Oh, if you want to get it back, you'll have to hire an attorney. You'll have to sue us. And if you can prove," are you ready for this? "If you can prove you weren't down here to buy drugs, we'll give you your money and your car back."
Maybe.
Now, you're not being arrested for anything.
Right. And I was going to say, the attorney that you hired, assuming you could hire one, they may decide he's guilty, too.
Oh, yeah, that's happened, too.
Yes.
And that is where the absurdity of this stuff continues. I don't mind, believe me. We get law enforcement back to what law enforcement's supposed to be doing, and that's protecting people from other people doing them harm. And I'll give you a perfect example, and it kind of surprised me, actually. Do you remember when the Boston bombing thing happened?
Sure.
And they had the last guy that they finally got out of the boat, you know, whatever. When they were leaving, when the police were pulling off of the thing after they had grabbed the guy, people were cheering and applauding them. And here's one of the things that I found interesting. They did all these house searches. They went through a bunch of different houses. I mean, hundreds of houses they searched. And they made not one ancillary arrest. And what I mean by that is they were let into the house to look for the guy that might be the bomber.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that in some of those houses, they saw, this is Boston, they saw a bong sitting someplace or a pipe sitting some. I'm sure they saw that, but they weren't looking for that. They were just looking for the bad guy, because I know of no arrests that were made that were ancillary to those searches. And that is exactly what people applaud us for, is when we're protecting them from other people. When we're sneaking around in your backyard, peeking in your windows, you don't like us at all. And I want to get law enforcement out of that. And secondly, when you talk about the violence on the streets and everything else, we're out there and we're creating the violence. We're making the violence by having this prohibition in effect. We could deal with this. Let's look at what we have done with the most addictive drug in this society, tobacco. We have gotten 10% or 50% of the adult smokers to quit completely. The vast majority of them, by the way, cold turkey, not a treatment program or anything like that. We only did two things. We educated the public about how dangerous this drug is, and we did something we learned from the Amish. We did a little shunning. You know, "Oh, I'm sorry, if you want to smoke that, you'll have to go outside." We made it not as convenient to smoke as it used to be. And since we took the support system off from underneath smoking, smoking has gone way down in the society. That's a success story that we can follow with other drugs, too. There's nothing, you know, these people act like if you're legalized drugs, you're condoning them. You ask any cigarette smoker in America today if they feel condoned.
Oh, of course. I want to go back to civil forfeiture a moment, because you can't overstate how terrible this is. And you mentioned human nature earlier, and you're right. We're not going to legislate human nature. Well, with civil forfeiture, you have states like a Maine or a Missouri or a NODAC or Vermont, where the money from a civil forfeiture is going into a neutral account in the state. Maybe proceeds go to the public education. Then you've got places like, as you well know, Texas or Georgia or Virginia, where there's no restrictions, and there's a program that I'm sure you know inside and out called the Federal Equitable Sharing Program, which, which allows local police to skirt the state restrictions. So Bal Harbour, Florida, where I used to live, this is, you know, about 3,500 very wealthy residents and no one else. They get a vice squad together. I mean, what vice? You know, somebody's upsetting the Americana Hotel. What's the deal? And they brought in $50 million in 3 years. They'd go all around the country. They'd do money laundering stings, and they could divide the cash with the federal agency involved. And finally, the DOJ shut that one down, just like the East Texas town that literally was the drag them off the interstate, sock it to them, J.P. Blues. They would take things like they took one woman's gold crucifix because that's all they could get. But when you talk human nature, if the cop shops are allowed to benefit directly and the officers involved are allowed to benefit directly, how the heck does anybody think they're going to stop that?
We have got police departments that figure their budget on projected forfeiture money.
Yes. And you
that's
know,
how they figure their budget. But this is the only thing I say about this that keeps a little light shining down at the other end of the tunnel for me to keep me heading that way.
Yeah.
Is that we had a lot of people in America made a very nice living off the Vietnam War.
Oh yes.
Okay, I mean the whole military industrial complex that Nixon warned us or that Eisenhower warned us about, all that stuff. Okay, but when the people realized that it was wrong, it ended. Even with all those profit making people trying to keep it going, and it's the same thing with this. These are bumps in the road. These are things that we have to overcome. They're things that we certainly have to talk about. Okay, because the people have to be aware of it. It might help them change their mind about how they're going to support this or not. But I honestly believe that once you get people to understand, you know, I got two words that I have my own definition for. The first one is the word fascist. And before I tell you my definition, I always start by saying that a good friend of mine that I used to work with said that there are two kinds of people in the world, the kind of people that think there's two kinds of people in the world, and the kind of people that are smarter than that. Okay? So I just want you to understand that before I say what I'm going to say next. My definition of the word fascist, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the normal people, and then there are the fascists. And here's how you tell the difference between the two. When a normal person has a great new idea, what the normal person does is they actualize it, they play it out. And if other people admire it, the normal person shares it with them. Now, I'm a capitalist. They may share it for a profit, okay? But upon a request, they share it with other people.
Mm-hmm.
When a fascist has a great new idea, the next thought that comes into the fascist's head is, this is such a good idea, we ought to make everybody do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you could be a fascist anything. You could be a fascist Democrat, a fascist Republican, you could be a fascist Libertarian, you could be a fascist anarchist.
Of course.
Okay? As long as you think you've got a right to force these opinions on other people. And then my other word that I have my own definition for is the word liberty. And I define liberty as the right to be as stupid as you choose to be, as long as you do not harm another person or another person's property. Now, when I say that, people kind of laugh and they say, well, yeah, you're just trying to make a joke. And
no.
I say, no, I'm not. I'm dead serious. And I'll tell you why. I have read a lot of history, and I have noticed a phenomenon that goes all back through our human history. And I call this phenomenon stupid, crazy, genius. And here's how it plays out. Again, Raleigh, you and I grew up together. You've been away for a long time, and you come back, and we're talking, and in the midst of this conversation, you ask me, how's Tom doing, who was an old friend of ours?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, we used to think Tom was pretty smart, but I'm telling you, he's stupid. He's wasted the last 2 years of his life over on top of the hill over there, and he actually thinks he's going to catch light inside of a glass ball and light the world. I mean, how stupid can you be? 2 years later, you're back in town again, and we're talking. You say, what's Tom up to? And I say, man, I told you he was stupid. Stupid. He's crazy. He's insane. He's wasted 4 years of his life on this stupid catch a light beside it. A year later, you come back in town, and before you have a chance to say hello, I say to you, did you hear about Tom? He's a genius. He caught light inside a glass ball. He's going to light the world. All throughout our history, stupid. The first person that thought of the new idea was labeled by everybody else as stupid. If they persisted, they were called crazy. And once the rest of us caught up, we called them geniuses. Now, I just want to make clear, I agree that more than 95% of the stupid people out there are, in fact, stupid. They're never going to be geniuses. No matter how long you wait, forget it. But here's the deal. As long as we need the geniuses, we have to protect all the stupid people. Because if we start destroying the stupid people, we're going to accidentally destroy some of the geniuses, too. So we have to allow them to do whatever crazy stuff they want to do, as long as they do not harm other people or other people's property. And then we get the benefit of the genius. And that I am for doing away with this stupid policy because I know it restricts us. All the stuff we're finding out now about medical marijuana and about the good uses for it, and it actually got some benefit. All the benefit we could have had in this country if we had been cultivating hemp and using it for fabric and using it for paper and using it for fuel, all of that stuff, when we look back on this, when we finally end this behavior, is going to be us being stupid, not the people that were telling us that we were wrong as being stupid.
I agree with all of it. How far do you think, and of course there's so many variables in that question, but how far do you think we are from a real paradigm shift where people realize how deleterious the war on drugs is as opposed to drugs and do something about it?
Well, if this was 1987 and I told you that the Berlin Wall would be down in 2 years, you would have told me I was out of my mind.
Right, and I'm hopeful.
And so you don't know. I'll tell you what I feel about this, and this has been what I've been saying since I retired in 1989. I've been doing this policy stuff for 25 years, the last 10 years since we got LEAP started with LEAP, but before that with another group called Reconsider and other groups. And I have said from the very beginning that I have no expectation of seeing an end to this policy in my lifetime. And let me use this as an example. The women's rights movement started in this country in the 1830s. Not one of those people that started that movement lived long enough to see the right to vote in 1920.
Correct.
They were all dead by then. But if they hadn't have done the work that they did through the 30s, 40s, and 50s, that right to vote might have been 1930 or 1940 rather than 1920. And that's the way I look at the work we're doing. I am now a complete human being. If I drop dead as soon as this phone call's over with, you'll know I died a perfectly happy man, and I'll tell you why I say that. At 17 years old, I made a promise to myself, and that promise was you will not have to work past your 45th birthday. I got into a profession that allowed me to retire at the age of 42. So I fulfilled that goal. That was the first goal I ever set for myself in life. When I retired, I said, I'm going to get involved in drug policy reform. I have no expectation of seeing an end to this policy in my lifetime, but I want to be fundamentally involved in bringing this policy to an end, and I'm one of the co-founders of what I believe is going to be the biggest voice in bringing this to an end, which is LEAP. So I have already fulfilled both the goals I've had in my life. I keep doing what I'm doing now because I want LEAP to be a success, and I want us to get out of this stuff. And it's interesting. When we first came up with LEAP and Jack Cole, the way I like to tell the story of LEAP is I had the idea for LEAP. And if it hadn't have been for Jack Cole, it would still be an idea because he's the one that did all the hard work of actually setting up the 501c3 and getting the business set up and, you know, doing all that stuff to do it. When we came up with the name for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, one of us said, the great thing about this name is when the drug war is over with, we don't have to go away.
Right.
Because there's other prohibitions of consensual adult activity out there that still are criminal justice problems and should never have been and should never be. They just had a big sexual slavery prostitution bust. If we had legal slavery in this country, there'd be no such thing as sexual slavery.
Yeah.
It would be illegal. It would be a legal regulated market. There'd be age limits set. There'd be safety for people would get physical checks. And I said this at a Rotary Club one time, and a guy, when I said, are there any questions, the guy says, well, it's nice that you support prostitution. I said, I don't support prostitution at all. I think it's terrible. And he said, well, you thought it should be legal. I said, yeah, of course it should be legal. That does not mean I support it.
Exactly.
You know, if anybody was asking me, should I go into this, I'd try to do anything in the world I could do to talk about of going into that profession. But if they decided to not take my advice, I wouldn't call them a criminal.
Right. And you would also do anything you could to make sure that no one was forced into it.
Oh, absolutely. And just like nobody should be forced into taking drugs by anybody. You know, I mean, I don't understand. The people that I have a problem with, the biggest problem with, are my conservative friends who don't get this. And they call themselves conservative, and they say over and over again how the government should get out of the way, and the best thing in this country is to let the people have the reign and let people do what they do, and we got to get the benefit of the people, and we got to get the government. And then they turn around without even breaking a smile and look at me and say, but that government should tell you what drugs you cannot take.
Oh, of course.
How does that fit into one head and not explode? How do you keep those two ideas in one place at one time? I don't understand it. You either want liberty or you don't want liberty. And if you walk around in the society you live in for 24 hours observing everything you can see and you see nothing that offends you, you do not live in a free society.
Exactly.
Because there's people that are being denied things that you would find offensive, but they're not doing them to you. Now, don't misunderstand me. If you see things that offend you, that doesn't mean you live in a free society. I mean, no. If I was walking around Germany in 1935, I would have saw things that offended me every second of the day. And it certainly wasn't a free society. But if everything is pleasing to your eye, that means other people are being denied their liberty. And see, this is the thing about liberty. I understand completely, thanks to my mother, that the only reason I have the liberties that I have is because you have the liberties that you have.
Right.
And anybody that can take your liberties away from you can take my liberties away from me. See, when I mentioned my mother had her own definition of what a fool was. And my mother used to say that a fool is a human being who, when meeting another human being for the first time, the fool is the one who doesn't first observe the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I was taught when I met a stranger, the first thing I noticed was my own reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I made an arrest, I always got a little flash of the mirror.
Right.
And it kind of made me remember that I wasn't special. This was just a job I was doing, you know, and that you could twist fate a little bit, and this picture could be 180 degrees around, you know. And that's the reason I do this out of my own selfish wants and needs. I want to live in a free society. I desperately want to live in a free society. And I know that that means that there's a whole bunch of people that are going to be allowed to do stuff that I would never, ever, ever do. But because it's a free society, as long as you're not forcing other people to do it, they're allowed to.
Well, that's it. Your rights end where mine begin, and no sooner. And it's a very libertarian philosophy, which I adopt 100%. The Republicans, of course, run screaming from it. They did everything they could to make sure Ron Paul was not viable in their own party, for instance. So, to say that conservative means that they're freedom-loving, no, they're just picking and choosing their particular battles here. But as we look at Washington, as I said at the outset, when you see these politicians and the overwhelming majority of today's politicians, if it was at the wrong place in the wrong time, their behavior would have made them a felon at some point, including including the denizens of the White House who have all admitted it over the last 20 years. So the hypocrisy in that is glaring. And the only way they get away with this is for the general public as a group to have been cowed into the fear that, oh, my God, we can't legalize drugs. Yeah. So I don't see this changing until we have a shift in public attitude, because there's too much in it for the people who are either making money or getting power from keeping it illegal.
I'll tell you something. LEAP is a 501c3. None of our, including me, none of our speakers are paid. We have paid staff that runs the office and stuff like that. Sure. The only law enforcement member of LEAP that gets a salary is our executive director, Neil Franklin. But all the other law enforcement people, by the way, anybody could be a member of LEAP, but in order to be a speaker for LEAP, you have to be from law enforcement.
Okay. Oh, good. So that's a good point, since it is a 501c3. Anybody can go to leap.cc and join.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But in order to be a speaker, you've got to be from law enforcement.
Right.
And the reason that I mention that is, I just got a report back from one of our Mike Smithson, who runs our Speakers Bureau. We averaged last month 5 presentations a day. Now, that's everything added together. Live presentations, right. Reporter stuff like this, radio, television, whatever. But we averaged 5 a day. We are creating the noise. None of our speakers are paid, but we cover all the expenses when the speakers travel. So we pay them per diem, we pay their sure. hotel and their mileage and all that stuff for when they travel, so it doesn't cost them anything.
Right.
So that costs money to do that. But we are a 501c3, so any donation made to us is tax deductible. It does cost us money to get people out there, but I think that anybody who really wants to see this end, and it's going to take some time, but if you really want to see this end, get involved. What's that old line about the only thing that allows bad things to keep happening is good people stay silent? Speak out, and if you got some extra cash rolling around and you want to give a nickel, dime, or a quarter, kick it into LEAP so that we can get more speakers out there and speak. Here's how LEAP, and I know we're getting to the end, here's how LEAP has changed the dynamic of the discussion in America today. If before LEAP you wanted to have a debate in your community about drug policy, you would have gotten the local NARC or the DA or whatever mm-hmm. to stand at one podium and stand there and say drugs are bad, they got us, you know, da, 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 da. And over at the other podium, you would have put the crazy hippie who would have stood there and said, hey, man, drugs are cool. Everybody ought to get high. Not hard to figure out where that's going to go.
Yeah.
Here's how we have changed the debate. If you want to have that debate today, I suggest you get the key drug policy guy in America today, a guy by the name of Gerlachowski. He's the drug czar. He runs the policy. Before becoming drug czar, he was chief of police of Seattle, Washington. Before he was chief of police of Seattle, Washington, Norm Stamper was chief of police of Seattle, Washington. He retired. Gerlachowski got the job that became drug czar. Norm Stamper today is a speaker for LEAP. So now if you want to have the debate, here's the debate. You going to believe this chief of police from Seattle, Washington, or you going to believe this chief of police from Seattle, Washington?
Excellent.
That's how LEAP has changed the dynamic.
And I thank you for it because, again, even individuals who are never going to be involved with drugs themselves and think they don't care, civil forfeiture alone could rope them in at any point.
Oh, yeah,
it affects every one of us. So, Peter, I hope you'll join me again.
Oh, love to, and we have a depth of field, so get other people on.
You betcha. Thanks.
Thank you, Raleigh.
Appreciate Bye-bye. It. So, yes, we will absolutely have someone else from LEAP. Next hour is for you. If you've got any comments on that, since you didn't call for Peter, yeah, call and yell at me. I'll take it.
It's the Raleigh James Show.